Words can't capture the significance of this moment, and there it is.
Incredible, and Nagukesh is also crying. Amazing, what a picture.
Nagukesh, I think in general, just like fully deserved it because he, overall, it did feel like he was the one kind of, you know, directing the action in this match.
He was always the one trying to win the games, taking extra chances when necessary, even when unnecessary. You actually gave him a very small edge. I think it was 55-45. I think I said that the match would be over after 11 or 12 games. Obviously, that was not the case.
Like, as someone, I was thinking, okay, yeah, Gukesh, of course, he's very young, and people say that, you know, he's not good in rapid blitz. On the other hand, despite all this, he's winning tournaments. So, like, you can say what you want, but that's relevant, no? And it did end up being relevant, of course.
But he wasn't the biggest surprise. For me, the biggest surprise was Vincent Keimer. I did not see that coming, especially because I see them as potential rivals for a very long time to come. Boom! We're live. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the C-Squared Podcast. Today, we are entering, or not today, but a couple of days ago, we've entered a new era in the world of chess, and that is, for the moment, the Gukesh era. We've exited the Ding Liren era. Everybody knows how that finished, and we are about to discuss it all. Fabiano, first of all, I guess we should just simply start with that final match. Game 14 of the World Championship match. To be honest, nobody that I know predicted a victory for Gukesh with the black pieces. A lot of people were already giving Ding as a slight favorite into the match, given that he had only one white and then the rapid tiebreaks in case of a draw. But then Gukesh, incredible strike at the end, came after an incredible blunder by Ding. But sum it up for us, Fabi. Your raw reaction after that.
Yeah, it was certainly very surprising. I mean, I won't say that I predicted or I didn't predict or I expected. I mean, I didn't expect these things. And basically, if you tried to say that you expected something like this, it does sound a bit like, you know, predictions made after the fact. I think that it was a surprise for most people. Like, I didn't feel anyone was a favorite. You know, I thought, okay, draw is the most likely, just by all logic, that a draw between two top players is very likely. And also because they're probably rather risk averse in that situation, right? Most people would be, even though it maybe doesn't seem logical. I think it's just human nature. I mean, at some point, obviously, you have to take risk because the match doesn't go on forever. You either win or lose at some designated stage, right? But in the 14th game, people are just going to be very risk averse, usually.
To build up on that, can you kind of describe, and you've been a spectator, but you've also been pretty much a player in one of those moments, the final game of the match. Let's discuss Magnus's approach as well. He's done it against Karjakin in his final game with the white pieces, took a quick draw, and he's done it somewhat against you as well, because he could feel probably that he has a better position in that final game, but did not want to risk. And it just goes to show that you have kind of the same vision as Magnus in this type of moments, the risk aversion.
Okay, so Magnus is very pragmatic.
Ding's mind. Yes, yeah. Yes. Keep going.
I mean, Magnus is a very pragmatic player. He basically decides what he thinks is the best path to a victory, what he thinks is the most likely to give him a favorable outcome. He could make a wrong assessment, but he will think about that and then he'll go for it.
I cannot like overstate the importance of Ding just playing these moves that we're going through right now, jumping in with the knight, jumping in with the queen. All of these moves, he played them so quickly and confidently. It was so heartening to see.
And most people do have that same approach in general. They're perhaps not as good at it, right? You know, to be like truly analytical in terms of trying to decide what's the best objective best path to a tournament or match victory, you have to leave very often your emotions out of it. And very often the emotions will be that if I have a better position, you know, I need to win, or if I think I'm superior to my opponent, then I need to win. But that's not always maybe the best way. Sometimes you might take undue risks, and in any individual game, of course, you it's not like you have a guarantee of winning. There's a percentage that you'll win, there's a percentage that you'll lose, and every outcome is possible. But the difference between game 14 and normal tournament, the game 14 of World Championship match and normal tournament is enormous. And even the difference between game 14 and game one is absolutely enormous, as we saw. You know, Gukesh in game one was perhaps playing a bit carelessly, and he wouldn't have played that way in game 14. That's just how it is. And that's the correct approach, most likely. And in terms of Ding, I think he was trying to play it safe. I mean, if you look at his opening, it wasn't like, let's say, a safe choice, but it was just a normal choice. Like, he's playing something that he's not taking crazy risks. I would say if I give an example of a crazy risk in terms of the opening, it would be to, for example, with the white pieces, like to play a reversed King's Indian.
Well, just to make a comparison, maybe we can do the comparison with the final game between him and Nepo from their respective match.
Yeah, there he was actually
H4. He tried to go completely insane, right?
But those risks weren't decided on, I assume, before the game. I think it was just that during the game he became attracted to this idea of H4, Knight G5, and so on. And it was just both objectively incorrect and also not really. I mean, it was too risky. It worked out for him because he didn't lose the game. He drew, but it was out of his hands. I mean, Jan was objectively winning at one stage of the game. So I didn't feel like that in the last game of this match. I mean, Ding didn't play. He wasn't like aiming for a draw from the first moves, but he didn't play something crazy. Like, okay, to me, something crazy would be like, let's say you play Knight of 3, D5, G3, C5, Bishop G2, Knight C6, and you don't play D4, right? You play Castle and you allow E5 and you play a reverse King's Indian, which is playable. I mean, it could turn into a huge fight, but you're suddenly like just throwing caution to wins. That's more something you would do in a must-win situation, just to give a kind of basic example. Or with the black pieces, you know, in a must-win game, you might consider, for example, to play the Rouser with black. But in a game where the match is tied, you probably won't want to play the Rouser. It would probably be considered a bit too risky. And most people, I think, would agree that they probably wouldn't be playing the Rouser in the game 14 if the match is tied with the black pieces. Just to give some examples of like what would be risky opening choices, what wouldn't be. Now, in terms of how the game proceeded, so I think the opening was interesting. Gukesh came up with a new idea. I'm like reasonably sure that this idea was devised during the match. I mean, maybe they had it in the bag before the match, but I would guess that it was devised during the match after Gukesh lost this game. Which game was it? It must have been 12. Game 12, right? Yeah,
game 12.
Game 12, yeah. 13, yep. Or basically Ding at some point was playing Knight of 3, G3, right? So if someone plays Knight of 3, D5, G3, then the most direct approach for black is how Gukesh played. You play C5, Bishop G2, Knight C6, and then you give the choice to white. You can either play D4 or you can play, as I said, some kind of reverse King's Indian, which people don't really do because the computer generally does not approve of that. So they play D4. This is like the critical approach. And then E6 castle. And like, for example, if you play Knight F6 here, you basically force a transposition to a Catalan, but a specific variation of the Catalan, C5 variation. So Gukesh came up with this line, CD4, Knight D4, Knight E7, which is, I checked it a bit, it's more or less completely new. It's not like a novelty, but it hasn't really been played by any strong players. Engines approve of it. It leads to equality objectively. So that's probably why he went for it. Now, he did at some point, like I don't consider this a risky choice from Gukesh at all. I think it was just basically he found something that was rare, or perhaps one of his seconds found and recommended to him, which was rare, which objectively leads to equality, which is perhaps not the most, let's say, like, if theory develops here, it's perhaps not the most clinical way to reach equality with black. But it's, if it's new, then you might be attracted to it. And I think Ding played extremely logically all his moves. I mean, everything up until, like, knight c3 castle and knight b5, everything here was played well from both sides. Ding was on his own. Gukesh probably knew something about the position. And the engine, both the weak one or strong one, will show that. After knight b5, black should be playing e5. And it is more or less equal. I mean, if white takes on d4, you take with the pawn. And black maintains this passed pawn on d4, which is not too weak. White has the bishop pair, but black has fine pieces and no real worries. But Gukesh played bishop b6, which gave Ding some chance to play for an advantage. For example, queen to e2 would have led to some sort of decent pressure for white. I mean, it's not a huge advantage, but it's decent pressure. Like, you're playing basically a risk-free position where if your opponent plays a bit inaccurately, perhaps white can start to play for a win. But he played b3, and after that his advantage kind of disappears again. And so then they both played well. Every move, basically, like, Gukesh was playing extremely well. I don't think that his moves were shocking by any means. I mean, bishop b6, knight d5, b5 is a good move. But they're all good moves, so you can only give him credit, even though they're perhaps not the most unusual or difficult moves. Cb5, I mean, I think basically after b5, Ding decided that he just wants to end the game. This is my feeling. Like, you could make a move here, you know, rook c1, whatever, and it is about equal, but the tension remains in the position. His next sequence of moves, to me, signals that he's basically saying, okay, let's just end the game concretely, simplify everything, and prepare for tie breaks. Which is an approach. I'm not being critical, just this is my impression of why he went for it.
He played this move a4 at some point, and it did feel like at that point, as you just mentioned, he was just looking forward towards tie breaks. Do you feel like he saw any risks in this approach? Because obviously you can just go queen to d4, follow it up with bishop to g4, try to exchange the bishops and make a draw quickly like that. When you play a4, you do risk losing that pawn on b3 for nothing, like it happened in the game, and then you have to, you know, defend a pawn down position in which most likely is going to be equal no matter what because of the limited material. But do you feel like he understood the risks, or he was still pretty much relaxed at that point?
You know, so I think a lot of people were very critical of a4. I think I'll be like moderately critical of it. It's definitely a bad decision. It was like the first step towards him losing the game. While the previous moves, basically, besides the small chance he had, status quo was not changed, right? It was, you know, equal opening. He got a slight chance, but basically everything remained about equal, and white was never in risk. And then after b4, of course, he already showed that he's happy with the draw. And in general, during this match, Ding was in equal positions, not really trying to press. I mean, Gukesh was the one trying to press, even sometimes in worse positions. But Ding was usually, if it's equal, then he's happy to head to a draw. Now, a4 feels like a bit of a nervous way of doing it, because a4 is basically saying, yes, I'm going towards a draw, but I'm accepting that I'll be on the worst side of it, because I have a weakness and you don't have a weakness. So yeah, there's a good chance that this weakness will fall, and probably a lot of pieces will get traded in the process. And yeah, we might get 3-2 rook endgame. It might just be a dead draw, but still, I'm accepting that I'm on the back foot. While if you play, for example, a move like rook to d4, and you follow up with rook d1, queen d2, and yeah, if you want to trade bishops at some moment, bishop d5, black is kind of tied to the weakness of b4, and a2 is not so easy to attack. Actually, it's really difficult to attack, because you don't have control of the a8 square, and you can't really pile pieces on that pawn. So although black has nothing to worry about, I don't really see why black is even symbolically better. Basically, I just see it as you can play rook d4, rook d1, and probably black's best thing is to just start trading a bunch of rooks. And then after the trade of even more pieces,
exactly,
again, yeah, we have the weakness of b4, the weakness of a2,
yeah,
and we will perhaps trade those pawns at some point, but already so many pieces are coming off the board that you know, a draw is just like almost guaranteed. And not only that, it's not like black is on the better side of it. It's just equal. And besides rook d4, you can do that in a variety of ways. Queen d4, as you mentioned, is probably a completely fine way of doing it. Bishop d5, if you want to try to trade the bishops off immediately and just like lead to even more drawish position. Obviously, without bishops, it's more drawish. But I like rook d4. I mean, you know, the only thing that I would be kind of concerned with white is a rook on c3 a bit of a concern for me? But I think that you can figure out that the rook on c3 doesn't do a great deal. You know, you could play like rook d1, rook c3, queen e2. I'm not looking at an engine, I'm just like looking at the position, thinking more or less what my thought process would be. Rook on c3 is not super threatening. And again, b4 is a weakness. So
I'm think that's the most like, natural. Yeah, rook d4, rook d1, bishop g4, exchange the bishops and make a draw basically.
Sure, yeah. It doesn't feel like white has any reason to even accept a worse position at this point. A4 is like, I'm not going to be super critical because it's not a huge objective mistake, but obviously, you know, you don't lose a position usually in one move, right? It might be an accumulation of small mistakes.
The way I see it, the problem with A4 is that it becomes a bit more difficult to exchange the bishops. If you exchange the bishops, okay, four rooks, even if you go 3-2, that's a very easy draw. Two rooks, 3-2 is extremely, extremely easy. And you will probably exchange the queens along the process when you lose that pawn, the pawn on B3. If you don't manage to exchange the bishops, as it happened during the game, you run the risk of having problems along the way, as we've seen, getting pushed back as he did. Yeah, I guess that's my perspective in terms of why I feel A4 was just such a critical mistake.
Yeah, to me, it's a very nervous move. It's definitely a mistake, not a mistake which changes the valuation in terms of like draw to losing. I mean, it changes it from draw to draw, just less pleasant draw. And
it changes a trend, yeah?
Yeah, it changes the trend. And also, in this kind of situation where a loss is a disaster, it's just the end, and a draw is totally fine for either player, it's very comfortable to be in a position where you can only either make a draw or win. And once we got the position, for example, after they traded, like, you know, Ding just immediately gave up the pawn, which again, I don't think he had to immediately give it up. But once you accept the pawn on B3 being a weakness, it is very likely at some point it falls. But he just immediately gave it up, which was a bit, and he traded rooks on A8, which was like, again, yeah, you could maybe say it's practical at this point to do it, or perhaps it just makes life a bit too easy for Gukesh. But if I'm in Gukesh's shoes, I really don't mind this. I mean, I had a slightly worse opening, and now I'm playing 3-2 with bishops on the board. It's, yeah, my chances of winning are probably super low. I mean, during the game, I'm basically thinking this game is a draw, but there is absolutely not a thought in my mind that I'll ever lose. And there's maybe like a small thought that I can play this for a bit. So,
I mean, these moments are extremely psychological. This final game moments in such a tense match are all psychological, and to have that type of edge coming from that opening, as you just mentioned, you've basically maximized whatever you could have gotten out of the middle game. It must just be a dream come true, and you could sense it also from the body language, right? He was playing fast, he wasn't overthinking, because okay, there's nothing to overthink, right? But he was putting that pressure on the clock as well, and it felt like
there's absolutely nothing you can be critical about from Gukesh's side.
No. He played a really good
game. He's not like reaching a winning position, but he had no opportunity to reach a winning position. He was slightly worse from the opening, then he equalized, and then he got a slightly better endgame, slightly more pleasant drawn and objectively drawn endgame.
Yeah.
I like saw a lot of this kind of rhetoric that Ding was, you know, happy, or part of him subconsciously was happy to lose, for whatever reason, to let go of the tension that he's been facing, which obviously there's a lot of tension.
I did not see that.
Playing this game. No, I mean, I saw it like by prominent, like at least one prominent grandmaster, and there was some agreement from other strong chess players. One who just said directly, like basically, I think his subconscious was hinting that he wants to lose. Which, when I look at his playing this game, I don't get that impression. I mean, he's burning time. He's like really very kind of methodically trying to trade off all the pieces. It really looks like he's desperate for a draw at some point in this game, like after the opening phase where he, you know, had a tiny edge, and then he kind of squandered it a bit. Then he was just trying to trade off all the pieces and also burning time in the process. This doesn't feel like, you know, someone who doesn't care about losing is just, okay, I'm throwing caution to winds, I'll play whatever random, like, you see sometimes Parham playing, Parham Uksutlu. This is obviously not meant as a criticism. It's more like, yeah, he's a very exciting player. Like, you know, sometimes he makes some extremely, like, responsible decisions, you know, just, I won't say carelessly, but just, you know, kind of throwing caution to the winds, and that's his style. But he makes, like, very risky decisions quickly sometimes. It can also work out very well. You wouldn't say, and I'm obviously not suggesting that he, like, tries to lose or anything. It's just that that's his style. He plays very, very risky chess. But someone who plays risky chess is someone who, like, plays really quickly and sometimes makes careless decisions. Sometimes they're very good decisions. You know, it's a bit of that. Not someone who's taking a lot of time and trying to trade off all the pieces. That's someone who really wants to draw the game, in my view of it, at least. Anyway, so they have this endgame. And then, like, the next, I don't know how many moves, probably like 20 moves we can basically just skip over, I guess.
Yeah, there's nothing, nothing there.
It's not very eventful, just, right?
Shuffling back and forth. Gukesh maximizing his position, but Ding still very much safe, right? And with the pawn g3, the pawns on f5 and g4, there's very, very few ways in which you can lose that position. And one of the ways in which you can lose was exactly how it happened in the game. Getting the
Gukesh pushed all his pawn.
Yes, go ahead.
And then they got this position where basically, you know, black is shuffling a bit because there are no really concrete ideas. Then Gukesh makes what ends up being a very consequential move on move 52. I don't know if he meant for it to be consequential or if he just played a move which attacked a piece. He played rook b2, he attacked the bishop. The bishop can, for example, go to g2. Absolutely nothing wrong with that. And the point is that if black ever attacks the pawn on b3, on g3 with, like, rook b3, you play king f2 and you just keep that pawn defended, and then you keep kind of waiting around with white. I mean, you can't do anything with white, and with black, since you have no useful pawn breaks, you have to at some point attack the g3 pawn or force white's king into a really bad position. I don't think that there's any way conceivably to do this. But okay, Ding played bishop a8. Obviously, it's not a bad move, but it ends up, it's like, you know, in a movie, you see, like, a character cough, and then 20 minutes later they have cancer or something, right? It's like this, you know, it's a move that you may not make much of it, bishop a8, but it ends up being the downfall. Although it's not a mistake. So after king f6, he played rook f4, king e5. And yeah, this is now, so this is where Ding makes basically the final move of the World Championship. This is the only really crucial move in the game. I mean, everything else in the game were, like, small mistakes you can be critical of. But if he had not played this move here, if he had played, for example, bishop to g2, which I think to me is, again, I'm just saying bishop g2, it's just seems like a good square for the bishop.
Bishop c6. For example,
I don't
bishop
want
bishop h1. I think even just, works.
No, bishop. I don't want to allow, like, rook b1. Oh yeah, it works.
Rook b1, I mean, king h2, right? I mean, I don't think
I just want to put my king on h2. I mean, I don't know, because the thing is, like, with the king on h2, I'm worried that at some point white black brings a bishop to e4, and then after white takes and rook g4, then e3, the pawn is basically just promoting. I want my king really close to the pawn if that ever happens.
Makes sense.
I actually think bishop h1 is, like, super risky. I don't know if I would bishop g2. Then if rook b1, I can play king f2. And then I just wait. And the thing is, like, black's only idea that I could think of was to play bishop b3, c2, e4, or somehow get the bishop to e4 in whatever manner you want. But then white takes on g4. And then, you know, black brings a king in at some point. Like, maybe white's king is on g1, cut off. Black plays king d4. And then white plays rook g8. And then rook a8 and gets this, like, long side defense. This is a typical defense in a rook endgame, right? And if e3, king f1, the king just, like, naturally can come over to defend the pawn. Otherwise,
yes,
you give checks. For example, king e3, you give check on a3. King e2, you play king g2. And or you don't even have to play king g2, or you just start pushing your g-pawn, perhaps. But it's basically just a draw with the long side defense. And instead, Ding played a move trying to trade rooks. You know, it's... on its surface, it's fine to trade rooks. Like, if White's bishop had been anywhere else on the board, for example, g2, not h1 again, but for example, g2, for example, c6, for example, e8, you know, the trade of rooks would not be an issue because it's, you know, essentially it's a good trade for White. It takes out the chance that you, even theoretical chance you lose, because then Black's only break is f4, and this leads to completely, like, there's no more pieces on the board.
As long as the bishops stay on the board.
Yeah, that's kind of the issue with the bishop on a8. That's why I mentioned that the bishop on a8 was the first sign that something was wrong. And people were critical of, you know, a4 in the game, but a4 would have been completely forgotten if Ding had played bishop g2 confidently and made a draw 25 moves later.
What's your explanation for rook f2? I mean, obviously it's a blind spot. It's a blunder, a cold shower that you sort of realize immediately after, and you could see it on his face as soon as he played rook to f2 and Gukesh started thinking, started showing through his mannerisms that he sees something. You could see Ding realize what he has done. What's your explanation for rook f2?
I think Ding realized once he let go of the rook, basically. I don't even know if Gukesh's expressions, which definitely gave it away. Like, Gukesh realized basically immediately, and I think the reason Gukesh realized so quickly is probably because he was trying to get this. I mean, he was maybe thinking about playing rook b1. And then
it's one of the few ways in which you can win, yes.
Yeah, basically, it's probably something that was on his mind for a while. Like, he wasn't expecting to get it, but he was maybe thinking, okay, I'll play rook b1, and yeah, White can play king f2. That's probably just a draw. White can play king g2. You know, maybe king h2 is what I want because the king gets a little bit farther away from the action. Or if White plays rook f1, then I win. Of course, it'll never happen, but yeah, it's just one of those things that you look at during the game. So as soon as he played rook f2, probably Gukesh had already seen before this move was played that it was bad. Now, Ding probably realized basically immediately because from my experience, whenever you make an absolutely awful blunder, which happens to everyone, you just realize immediately. It's just like instantaneous. It's one of those things. I don't know what it is, but it's like, couldn't my brain have told me a second earlier that this was going to lose me the game? But yeah, they both realized instantly. It's not difficult. It's not a difficult position to draw. It's not a difficult position to figure out rook f2 is losing. It's basically just Ding was super tired because he just was, because it's a long match. And he had a moment of loss of concentration. And also, if you're very nervous, which he probably was, because again, it is a tough match, then you can tend to you know, lose tension a bit, because, you know, maybe your body is just like a bit too tense and just wants to relax for a second. The issue is that relaxing for a second can sometimes lead to this, right? Now, it was a bit unlucky in the sense that you can also relax and just play bishop g2. But yeah, that's just how it goes, you know? It's in some sense unlucky, but also in some sense it's deserved, because yeah, I mean, you have a drawn position. It is basically, it is a kind of trivial task. So if you lose in one move in this position, like, it's the same as if you played bishop b7. It's a very basic mistake. And we can understand why it would happen, just because, like, you just like had a kind of 5-second mental collapse. It happens to everyone. But on the other hand, if it happens, then you probably deserve to lose too. It's just how these things work out. It's not an indictment on someone's chess. Just, you know, the margins are kind of fine. So any mistake at this point in the match is the last one. I was kind of disappointed, just because I wanted to see a tiebreak. I thought it would be fun.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I think
see it end in this way. Also. Like, to me, it was very logical that Gukesh won the match in general. I mean, I accept it as the most logical result, because he's had better results over the past year by an enormous margin. So that just feels like he's playing the better chess in general. But for it to end with a crude blunder is a bit unsatisfying. Just you want to see kind of, like the last match, Ding and Yan, they made a million mistakes, but the finish was extremely, extremely climactic. You couldn't have hoped for more, you know? Just like a full-fledged going down to the wire last seconds game, instead of the game kind of ends unceremoniously with rook to f2. But that's what happens. I mean, Gukesh, I think in general just like fully deserved it, because he overall, it did feel like he was the one kind of, you know, directing the action in this match.
He was always the one trying to win the games, taking extra chances when necessary, even when unnecessary. We've seen him take extra chances that could have led to him losing some games. But it did feel like he was the one that was pushing the pace, putting the pressure on his opponent. It felt like Ding was happy to try to stir the match into the tiebreaks. With that being said, I do feel like Ding was a completely different person and a completely different player than what we've seen for the past year and a half since the last World Championship match. He was, in fact, putting tremendous resistance in difficult situations. I think even after he lost that second game, down 1 point, immediately strikes back with probably his best game in many, many years. So he brought that fighting spirit, which I think was something that we were missing from him during his last few competitions. And everybody pretty much noticed that as well. He was saying that he was having a tough time. It felt like he found that spirit once again to fight through adversity and to fight through such a long match. But of course, unfortunately, his reign as the world champion now ends. The reign of Gukesh starts at least until 2026. It's a very different, very, very different world champion. You could say that the reign of Ding was a bit inconsequential. He's somewhat of more of a secluded player. He doesn't like to be in the spotlight too much. He has not played a lot of chess while he was a world champion. We know that Gukesh, most likely, given his age, given his general motivation, and of course, given that he's from India, India is becoming an absolute powerhouse, not only from a playing perspective, but from a media perspective as well. It's a completely new era. How do you see this one play out, the new one, the Gukesh era?
I mean, for me, Gukesh is a much more logical world champion. I mean, again, I'm not trying to take things away from Ding. Like, Ding is really a player I respect a lot. But in terms of the play over the last year, 2 years, okay, Gukesh is very young, so we can't go back too far in terms of play, because at some point he was just a developing player. But Gukesh has had major tournament victories, including the candidates under his on his resume. While Ding, you know, after like 2019, his like one bright moment was the match. It just happened to be a world championship match. It was that important. Like he really had his success at the right moment. Now, in terms of like, I wasn't surprised that Ding played overall, you know, a good match and played much better than he played in some of the other events we saw this year, because Ding is a good match player, and a match in a tournament are just very different things. In a tournament, it's very easy to get demoralized if you're behind, you know, you're minus one, so you lose one game. And then you just wonder what you're doing there, and it's very easy to lose hope. And then you can spiral a bit. In a match, basically you have one goal. So it can be quite, I wouldn't say it's easy, but it can definitely be easier to motivate yourself with the thought that, you know, I just keep the match close and I get some chances and it's either win or lose. So I'm basically here to either win or to lose. In a tournament, there's all sorts of places. And it might be difficult to motivate yourself for third place rather than, you know, eighth place, for example. Also, in a lot of these events where Ding was performing poorly, they were really unforgiving events, because a lot of them were also mixed rapid blitz, and those can be really unforgiving, where you're playing like multiple games a day, you're playing different time controls, you're playing against people who are like really first of all, not stressed, because like in a world championship match, your opponent is just as stressed as you are, just by nature. Nobody's going to avoid the stress of a world championship match. While in a tournament, people can be relaxed and a lot of them can just be in a good mood and just playing inspired chess. And you might just be like an easy target for people. So we can't like take out the other factors of why someone is playing poorly. It's not just because of chess. It can be because of other factors as well. Like there's a lot of factors that go into it. So Ding's poor play is not because over the last year, not this match, but Ding's poor play over like, let's say the last year is not because he is inferior to other players. It's because, you know, other things were going wrong for him. Like in Norway, it was just very visibly, he didn't want to be there and he was just doubting himself enormously. And in other tournaments as well, that felt to be the case. So so that was a close match. I really never felt that Gukesh, I think I said this from the start, I never felt Gukesh was a heavy favorite or something. You know, he, by all the numbers, we have to put him as a favorite at the start, but it's not one of those like, you know, 2800.
You actually gave him a very small edge. I think it was 55-45. I think I said that the match would be over after 11 or 12 games. Obviously that was not the case.
I gave different predictions because I get bored. Like everyone was asking me for half a year, what's your prediction? And I just get bored of saying the same thing. So I just kept changing my prediction. But it's just like, what are people expecting? You know, you just ask like the same exact question 12 times. You expect me to come up with the same answer every time? I'm going to tell you something different every time.
I think you were pretty accurate. You were pretty accurate. I mean, it was Gukesh who was the favorite. It was Gukesh who dictated the pace, but it was always very, very close.
Yeah, it was a close match and it could have been even closer. I mean, like really, I think after King E5, you know, even knowing what happened, I would still stand by that, like Ding is defending his endgame, you know, at least 9 times out of 10, if not 19 times out of 20. I mean, it's a pretty trivial endgame. The only thing that could go wrong is a blackout. That's what happened. And in a tiebreak, again, I definitely would disagree with someone saying that Ding is a heavy favorite. I think it's just really close. I mean, looking back on the match now, I would probably say Gukesh is a favorite in the tiebreak, just because, you know, in like these kind of final crunch moments, Ding did make some really, really serious blunders, which Gukesh was not making. I mean, the Queen C8 dropping a piece in one move, this one, it was showing a trend that he was starting to blunder, you know, game ending blunders. So that, even if like he was sometimes outplaying Gukesh in very important games, like game 12, just outplaying him, the game ending blunders can be more significant because those can strike at any moment and you can't recover from them. While being outplayed, you can sometimes recover from, you know, being outclassed positionally. Sometimes it happens to everyone and it's not always the end of the game. But these kinds of blunders, you know, in a very close match, those are usually going to be a decider. So seeing like maybe that he had blundered a knight already should have been a bad sign for that maybe another blunder could strike. And we shouldn't minimize the severity of this blunder. I saw some people saying that because commentators were missing it immediately, that it wasn't so obvious. But like really, it is a simple tactic, Rook F2. I mean, it's not difficult. I'm not saying that to be overly critical. It's just not that difficult. And the fact that both players saw it pretty much immediately is kind of indicative of that. You know, Gukesh literally as soon as it was played, and Ding basically, I think, as soon as he played it.
Gukesh has 1 hour 7 minutes. He plays Rook F2. And it's a huge blunder. It's a huge blunder. Let's look at Gukesh's expressions here. Look at him. He zones in. He can't believe. He can't believe what has happened here. He moves in. He's like, what? Ding, did you really play this? Guys, the winning idea is to take the rook and put the bishop on d5. And look at Gukesh. He's seen it. He can't believe it. The world championship is moments away. Because if he wins this, he becomes the world champion.
Yeah. The match was overall, I'm like a bit sad that I missed the final game because it just like ended so early. I mean, for our time.
You didn't wake up, right, in time?
No, because I also thought, like, why am I sacrificing sleep over a game that might not be too interesting?
No, it was the same for me. I woke up and I saw the result. The result was already posted. I think I woke up maybe 15 minutes too late. But yes, for us, it was, I think I woke up at like 7:30 and the game was already over.
Yes, like if you really think that this game is probably going to be a draw, it might not. You might be like, okay, I'm really going to be hyped for the tiebreak. And I think we probably would have covered the tiebreak had it happened.
For sure. Right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But what to do?
Tell me about Ding. Sorry, not Ding. Gukesh, obviously. Overall, the chess world did not have a lot of time to get adjusted to his rise. He's been on an absolute tear. Obviously, we've seen him coming. We did not anticipate him becoming such a powerhouse in so little time. Now, and I'm talking about powerhouse in terms of the titles that he's managed to get in such a short amount of time. Eric Aissi is still higher rated than him, but Gukesh was the one performing when he needed the candidates, the Olympiad, and now the World Championship match. What is it about Gukesh that makes him so efficient when it comes to these high pressure moments? Is it his style? Is it his preparation? Is it, or is it something else? His mindset, perhaps? What would you attribute his efficiency to?
Look, I mean, there's a few things about Gukesh. So first of all, he is very young. So he is, I won't say he's the youngest world champion because there was Ponomarev, but certainly we can say he was the youngest undisputed world champion. And also with Ponomarev, it was very close. Like, they're both basically the same age. I think they're both 18 and a tiny bit. And Gukesh has shown for quite a while the ability to either fight for winning tournaments or win tournaments, which, like, some people value things differently. So some people value, like, showing very exciting ideas. Some people value creativity. Some, like, for everyone, there's a different kind of metric for which they value a player.
Correct.
Some people just value what they feel is like natural instinct or gift, which, again, we've been into that. That means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But for me, one of the things which I've always valued a lot is, like, the ability to win tournaments and the ability to also be in the running for tournaments, running for like first place. So you don't always win, but sometimes you're fighting until the end.
To put yourself in the position going into that final round.
Yeah, and the reason why you win a lot of tournaments is also because you're fighting till it, like, let's say you're always in contention going into the last round. Now you're going to have a certain percentage that you mess up and a certain percentage that you win, but obviously your percentage will be much higher than the person who only is in contention half the time going into the last round, just by the numbers, just statistics, that's how it's going to be,
of course.
And so for quite a while, Gukesh has been one of those players who, he's not always finishing the job, but he is usually fighting for first. And that's a quality that for me is very important. Like, not all players have that. I mean, even players who are around his rating, sometimes they just don't have that quality. And even players a lot older than him have won, older than him and also some of the best in the world, have won around the same amount of tournaments or less, despite playing for a decade more. So, like, the ability to fight for a win and to win is, I think, like, as someone, I was thinking, okay, yeah, Gukesh, of course, he's very young, and people say that, you know, he's not good in Rapid and Blitz. On the other hand, despite all this, he's winning tournaments. So, like, you can say what you want, but that's relevant enough. And it did end up being relevant. Of course, these things could have changed differently very easily, right? I mean, you know, we talk about Arjun and Gukesh. At some point, they were both fighting for a qualification spot in the candidates in the World Cup. And Pragnananta too. And neither Gukesh or Arjun made it, but Pragnananta did. And so at that stage, maybe you think, okay, Pragnananta is the front runner among these very young players. So it can all change very quickly, and, you know, qualification, it's all based on very fine details, right? Now, as it turned out, Gukesh is the world champion. When he actually needed to win, the things that he needed to win, he did win. That's all we can really say. He won things that he needed to win. They happen to be very, very important things. And deservedly, then he is the world champion. Now, yeah, so, I mean, going back to, like, the tournament winning thing, I mean, I noticed this also, it was quite a while ago. It was, like, 2023, I think, WR Masters. He didn't win, Levon won the tournament. But it was a tie for first between Levon, Gukesh, and Jan Neponishi. And I think first Gukesh beat Jan in a playoff, and then Levon beat Gukesh, but it was all very close. And I was pretty impressed at the time that someone who's like 16, 17, whatever age he was, but obviously significantly younger than the players he was competing against, that he was basically able to fight for first in a tournament and almost win it. And then he did the same in Tata Steel this year, before candidates, before anything else. So people were not thinking like Gukesh is, you know, if we go back to the start of the year, people were not thinking Gukesh is necessarily a favorite in Tata Steel. But he scored plus four. Again, he lost the tiebreak against, I think, Wei Yi. Wei Yi won the tournament. Or maybe it was Notarbek. Like, there was a big tie, right?
No, Wei won the tournament.
There was a big tie, so I don't know.
With Notarbek, Anish, and Wei.
Yeah, and Gukesh. But, yes. Like, I forget who Gukesh played in the playoff. It might have been Notarbek. Anyway.
You mean the finals?
Like, I don't think he got to the finals. I think it was Wei Yi against Notarbek in the finals. That's the thing. So I don't know who Gukesh lost to in his match. But anyway, the fact that he was again in plus four and fighting for first, and then he did win the candidates, he won the Chennai tournament. You know, he had a few like crashes. I mean, the like Grand Swiss last year. So he wasn't immune from bad results. And if I go back to the Grand Swiss, of course, it would be hard to imagine that it is only a year ago, that Gukesh, who was struggling so much in that tournament, would be the world champion next year. But yeah, he won the candidates very convincingly, and the match wasn't one-sided by any means, but he won the match. So he did everything he needed to do.
Yeah, no. And I think you pointed out a very good factor, and that is it seems to be his general mentality, his general trend where he puts himself in a position to win. And sometimes, a lot of times, it works out for him. So I think this is an attribute not a lot of people have. And I think it's a very, very good point that you just made. Cool. All right.
I mean, I think that like Arjun and Notarbek, they also do have this quality. Notarbek does. Well, the thing is, like, Notarbek is less stable than Gukesh, notably so. I mean, the stability is different. You know, they're both very often fighting for winning tournaments, but Notarbek has more, like, sometimes downtrends or just like weak periods throughout a tournament.
And we haven't seen Arjun that often in classical events against the top rated players, like close events.
Yeah, Arjun was my prediction a few years ago, you know, but okay. I mean, Arjun has fulfilled many.
He's the highest rated player. Yeah.
He's 2800. Like, you obviously can't speak badly about the chess of someone who's 2800. I mean, that's also very significant. Just he hasn't played the world championship cycle yet. Probably next time. I would bet on it that he would qualify next time, but for the moment, yeah, he hasn't played yet. And neither has Notarbek, for that matter. And you know, I wouldn't count out any of the young players like Pragnanta, despite perhaps having not of a great year. I really wouldn't count out any of these young players. I mean, they have so many years of good chess ahead of them. It's really just too early to say what their potential is or what their results will be. But obviously they're going to be very good.
Yeah.
that's for sure. Just
for a very long time.
For a very long time. Just how good is a bit more difficult to judge.
Cool, Fabi. Yeah. One more question, actually. Yeah, I've said it would be my last question, but one more question, because there were some surprises in the name of the seconds, especially of Gukesh. We don't know much about the seconds of Ding, but we've had Duda, which was somewhat of a surprise. Obviously, it seems to have been a Polish cluster being built around Gukesh. That's obviously the that's due to Gajewski being his head coach. But you also had Klimkowski, I think that's his name, who is an international master, very young, very promising. But he wasn't the biggest surprise. For me, the biggest surprise was Vincent Kaimer. I did not see that coming, especially because I see them as potential rivals for a very long time to come. Were you surprised by any of the names? And how do you think those connections were made and those connections generally worked?
No, I mean, I wasn't surprised. Like, I didn't expect it, but it no name would be a surprise to me, unless it was someone who wasn't in chess, but that he worked with, like, very, very strong chess players. It's hard for it to be a surprise. I mean, if we're talking about Duda, then it's not too hard to understand how that occurred, because he's worked with Gajewski for a long time, and that connection happened very naturally, because Gajewski was, for many, many years, the second, one of the main seconds of Vichy Anand. And Vichy Anand and Gukesh have had some connection as well, in terms of, you know, Vichy has his chess program. I don't know exactly the details, but obviously he's been somewhat connected to the development of the young Indian players. So that Gajewski started to work with Gukesh happened maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe it was 2 years ago. I don't know exactly, but
it was pretty organic, right?
Yeah. And then that Gajewski has close connections with some of the Polish players is also not strange. I mean, it's just normal. And I don't know much about Klimkowski. He's a young grandmaster. I that's about all I know about him. But it's not too strange to take on one of the young guys, because they're very motivated. In terms of Kaimer, again, maybe they're just friends. Now, I've in the past, when I was younger, I've been asked to work with a number of players, and I've always kind of weighed it internally, like, do I want to work for someone else? And I don't think there's a good or bad decision on that. I've always said no, because that's my personal preference. I don't want to work for someone who I feel like will be a very close competitor. The only exception was I've worked with Lebon, but never in a very official capacity. Just we've worked, like, you know, kind of as friends and like sparring partners and so on. But like a long time ago, when I was not a top player, I was asked to work for Veselin, for example. This must have been like 2009. And then in 2013, I was invited to work with Magnus, but it was just like a one-time thing. It wasn't really like working with him. I think it was just be training games or blitz games or something like that. And then when Sergei Karjakin qualified for the match, I was also invited to train with him, probably not as like an analyst, but like sparring partner. And I always felt a little bit weird about it, but perhaps for Vincent, it's just very natural that he has no issue with training with someone and then also competing with them after. That's a personal thing.
Maybe takes some of the tendencies, the analytical tendencies, from his main coach for a long time, Peter Lekko, and perhaps he's attracted to this type of work because of that?
Well, my assumption would be more so, and again, I'm just speculating, I have no idea, would be more so that, like, for example, Gajewski, who is probably like the main coach, will be in charge of most of the analytical stuff and will also draw on ideas of other people, but he might be kind of the one who is like organizing most of the analytical work. And then if you invite a top player like Vincent, it might be more for playing a lot of training games, or for example, Duda, it might be for playing a lot of training games. And the opening analytical work might be less of a focus for them. Like, if I invited a top player, I probably wouldn't be it would probably be more for practice, not because I want them to work on my openings necessarily. But again, that's just speculation. I have no idea how they formulate.
I think Vincent was doing a lot of analytical work, and again, also speculation. But I think they posted the picture from Spain during the match, so I would assume he wasn't doing any like sparring during the match.
Oh yeah, no, this is, I'm talking before the match. During the match, yeah, you probably don't want to play too many training games or anything. I mean, maybe on the free day, but like, we definitely played games in 2018 during the free days, but I guess you don't have so much time for that, and you don't want to be playing chess constantly. Like, you might also want a break. Yeah, that could have been remote work. I mean, it's, I would have definitely been interested to see inside how they work, just also how Ding was working. I would have been interested to see inside. I think like my comment that we made live, which was mostly like joking, was taken a bit harshly. Some people took exception to it, that I said that like Ding, that evidence of his work is not there at all. Obviously that was kind of a, you know, a half joking exaggeration. I mean, they did work, that's clear, right? But definitely Ding's work, I would say like this, I don't think it's speculation. I think I'm like reasonably certain about this. Ding's like level of organization and work was far less meticulous than Gukesh's. I mean, that I think is, would be shocking if it weren't the case. Gukesh was obviously very organized, structured, like absolutely classic sort of, you know, world championship prep. And Ding looked a bit more haphazard to me, and they definitely worked. It just was more like, the interesting thing is that you can get by with both approaches. Like, you don't need to, it's probably, you probably maximize your chances by working meticulously and organizing very well, but it's not a guarantee of success, and preparing less seriously is not a guarantee of failure. And it's possible also to overwork. So it's not like, it's very, very difficult to find the absolute like happy medium, you know, that you might need. But yeah, I think they took the match seriously, professionally. It looked like probably a good team behind it all. It's how I would also organize a team, more or less, you know, find people that you enjoy working with and get them together and try to get to your best shape. That would also be my approach. So that's more or less how it looked like.
Awesome. Fabi, I think we covered pretty much everything, or at least as much as we could have. In this case, it was a great match. It was a good fight. And of course, big congratulations to Gukesh for becoming the 18th, I believe, world champion. You never know how they count it. Yeah, big moment in the world of chess. Obviously, we will get to assimilate all of these changes in the upcoming months, year and a half. You are taking a big step towards qualifying for the next candidates. So, you know, we could be having a lot of these type of discussions in the upcoming future. But yes, great match. Congratulations to Gukesh. World Rapid and Blitz is next. We don't know if we're going to see either of these players in that one, but that's for another episode.
I think it's reasonably certain that they're not playing. I mean, I saw something. I think Ding is
highly unlikely. Highly unlikely that.
Actually, I think also I saw something that he probably won't play, which I understand. I mean, I might feel the same way if I played a long match. You know, just want to take a break for a bit.
I think that's the best way to do it. Yeah, no, absolutely. Again, digest these type of successes. I think it's extremely important psychologically to get the benefits, the mental, the psychological benefits of winning such an important championship. Anyway, we have some interesting, hopefully some interesting guests. We're trying to make some guests happen for the next couple of weeks. And of course, the World Rapid and Blitz, that one is coming quickly in New York. New York. I don't know, man. The East Coast is getting hit with all of these drone stories. Have you been following?
I saw something.
Hopefully we're not going to have any surprises in New York, but I've been following. I'm deep into the drone stories. We don't have time to go into that, maybe next time. But yeah, cool chatting, cool catching up, and I will see you and everybody else, all the viewers, in the next episode. Cheers, guys.